The Federal News Update for Wednesday, December 31st, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and if you thought the federal machine slowed down for the holidays, you were profoundly wrong.
Not at all. I mean, this is one of the most consequential 48-hour periods we have archived all year.
We're talking December 30th and 31st, 2025.
Exactly. Our source material, the internal operational logs, they show just an unrelenting barrage of high-consequence activity across all three branches: executive, judiciary, and legislative.
And that's really the mission today, isn't it? To move beyond the headlines and create an exhaustive, granular, archival record.
Absolutely. We're prioritizing depth and technical nuance.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the devil is always in the details of the policy mechanism.
This is the unabridged log.
We have a lot of ground to cover. I think we should start right at the top.
White House policy posture.
Right. It sends immediate signals, both to the workforce and to the broader regulatory landscape.
Okay, let's start with an action that sounds routine, but carries massive institutional weight. The publication of Executive Order 14368. What exactly did that formalize on December 30th?
So this is the critical final step in setting pay for the coming year.
Right.
The president signed it on December 18th, but Executive Order 14368 was legally promulgated, meaning, you know, officially published in the Federal Register on December 30, 2025.
And the detail here isn't just one agency. We're talking about the entire federal operation, correct?
It covers everyone.
Yeah.
It finalizes the 2026 pay schedules for the entire civilian federal workforce, the Foreign Service, and crucially, the uniformed services.
And the why behind this?
Well, it's statutory. It formalizes the annual cost of living adjustments, or COLAs, that are mandated by law. This is just essential for preventing mass attrition.
If you don't adjust pay to keep up with inflation, you lose your career employees.
You lose them. Simple as that.
That statutory function is the fascinating paradox of this administration's civil service policy, though. Well, on one hand, you have this legal requirement, this baseline pay progression that has to be maintained just to keep the lights on.
Sure.
But what is the administration doing simultaneously that directly undermines the security offered by that pay progression?
Right. They are maintaining the statutory COLA structure, but at the same time, they are aggressively pursuing these broad structural workforce reduction efforts.
You're talking about Schedule F.
We've discussed the potential use of Schedule F extensively. And that policy, it's designed to reclassify tens of thousands of career positions as policymaking roles.
Which strips them of due process.
It strips them of due process and allows for much, much easier termination.
So it's a bifurcated approach. They give a legally mandated raise with one hand while holding this massive organizational restructuring threat, Schedule F, over the head of the career civil servant with the other.
It creates an incredible institutional tension moving into 2026. I mean, you have pay stability mandated by law, but your job stability is under existential threat by policy.
And that tension is a huge driver for people leaving.
A great deal of the voluntary departures we've seen, especially among senior executives. And tying into this broader policy alignment, we also saw a strong signal sent outside the federal workforce.
The anti-DEI enforcement statement.
From the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC.
Now, that's just a statement, not a regulation, but what kind of impact does that have on the corporate landscape?
It signals a definitive federal crackdown on corporate diversity quotas. It fits the administration's broader policy alignment, you know, indicating that the federal government will use its enforcement power to challenge these established institutional norms.
So it's an extension of political will into the private sector.
Using the EEOC as the policy vehicle. Exactly.
Okay, that gives us the domestic policy posture. Let's immediately pivot, because the most urgent activity over these 48 hours was really focused on leveraging U.S. financial power abroad.
We're moving directly into global economic warfare.
It seems like it.
This was a highly coordinated diplomatic and financial offensive. The Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, issued one of the most sweeping sets of sanctions we've seen this quarter.
How many?
Targeting 10 individuals and entities across two continents.
10 is a huge number for a single tranche of sanctions. What was the stated strategic goal, and what were the specific authorities they leveraged to do this?
The stated goal was a direct response to what the administration called aggressive and reckless proliferation.
Okay.
And they leveraged not one, but two distinct executive orders.
Yeah.
First, Executive Order 13382, which is sort of the foundational authority for targeting proliferators of weapons of mass destruction.
Right, the WMD order.
And second, Executive Order 13949, which specifically addresses conventional arms transfers involving Iran.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because the targets weren't just in Iran. Treasury specifically identified Venezuela as a co-producer and a forward operating base.
Mm-hmm.
How significant is that framing?
It's a massive escalation. I mean, Venezuela is no longer just a customer for Iranian military hardware.
They're building it there.
They are now actively involved in the manufacturing process. Treasury Under Secretary John K. Hurley framed the action explicitly. He said they are weaponizing the U.S. financial system to effectively quarantine the Venezuelan defense sector.
So cutting off its access to dollars to the global financial grid?
Completely. They are treating Venezuela as a direct extension of Iran's military-industrial complex.
That requires us to systematically review the sanctioned entities then, because they demonstrate a highly granular targeted strategy. It looks like they're attacking both the finished product and the raw materials.
That's the approach.
Let's start with Venezuela, the assembly point.
Okay, target number one is Empresa Aeronautica Nacional S.A., or EANSA.
EANSA.
This is a state-owned aviation entity operating in Venezuela. Its designated role is overseeing the assembly and maintenance of the Iranian-designed Mohajer series UAVs.
So combat drones.
Combat drones. And the strategic implication here is profound. ENSA marks Venezuela's formal transition from being just a buyer,
right,
to becoming a licensed manufacturer. This gives Iran a localized Western Hemispheric base for drone production.
And who in Venezuela is designated as the primary coordinator for all of this?
That would be Jose Sordaneta Gonzalez. He's the chairman of ENSA, also based in Venezuela.
And they designated him personally.
They did. He's the key interlocutor coordinating UAV production directly with Iranian advisors. The personal designation is a protocol used to isolate leadership and ensure immediate asset freezing.
So he can no longer travel or hold assets that touch the U.S. financial system.
He's cut off.
Okay, so we've hit the final product assembly and the local management. Now, let's pivot back to Iran, where Treasury meticulously targeted the upstream supply chain for ballistic missiles. Who was the key procurement agent they isolated?
That would be Mostafa Rostami Sani, based in Iran. He was designated as a procurement agent for Parchin Chemical Industries, or PCI.
PCI is a name we've heard before. They're notorious.
They are. And Rostami Sani, he specializes in sourcing specific dual-use chemicals, materials that have civilian uses, but are essential for sophisticated weapons needed for ballistic missile propellants.
So this is targeting the chemical engineering foundation of their entire program. How is Rostami Sani masking the origin of these sensitive chemical imports?
Through target number four, Partisan Rezan Shahr International.
A front company.
A classic example of a front company. It's owned or controlled by Rostami Sani and was used explicitly to mask the true end user, which was PCI, to circumvent international export controls. This designation exposes their specific deceptive trade practices.
That covers the fuel, the propellants. What about the advanced components, the electronics, the guidance, the radar systems for the drones themselves?
They hit two specific manufacturers there. Target 5 is Fanavari Electro Mojaben Company.
What's their role?
This is a subsidiary of the Ryan Fan Group, RFKA. Their role is manufacturing electronic components, essential for the IRGC's aerospace division.
So by hitting them, Treasury is directly degrading the electronic warfare and guidance capabilities of the drone fleet.
That's the goal.
And the final target. It looks like it focuses specifically on surveillance capabilities.
It does. That's Kavosh Garan Asman Mojgadir Company, or KAMG. This Iranian firm is controlled by an individual named Bahram Rezai. KAMG's specialty is procuring highly sensitive avionics and radar systems,
which would impact the ISR.
This action targets the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities of Iran's flagship combat drone, the Mohajer 6 platform.
I want to zoom in on the technical specificity you mentioned about the precursor chemicals. What are the specific materials Treasury is trying to choke off by hitting Rostami Sani's network? This is where the archival detail becomes so crucial.
It's all about chemical feedstock. Treasury specifically identified the procurement of sodium perchlorate and nitrocellulose.
Sodium perchlorate.
Right. Sodium perchlorate is the primary oxidizer used to create ammonium perchlorate, which is the key ingredient in solid propellant for, virtually all modern solid fuel rocket motors.
So the strategic logic is incredibly holistic. It's not just intercepting the finished weapons.
Yeah.
It's attacking the final assembly line in Venezuela and simultaneously strangling the upstream supply chain.
Right. By targeting the foundational chemistry, the specialized oxidizers needed for solid fuel propellants in the Middle East.
It's full-spectrum economic warfare, maximizing the U.S. financial systems as a weapon of statecraft.
And this financial action was immediately amplified by the diplomatic arm.
Secretary Marco Rubio's State Department issued a press statement concurrent with the Treasury action. How did they frame Iran's presence in Venezuela?
They categorized it as an intolerable violation of hemispheric security norms.
That is very strong language.
It is. And the language used was highly charged. They specifically referenced the threat to U.S. interests in our region.
That phrasing, U.S. interests in our region, is significant. I mean, it implies a very aggressive 21st century application of the Monroe Doctrine.
Absolutely. The Monroe Doctrine historically dictated that the U.S. would oppose intervention by external powers in Latin American politics.
And by using this framing,
the State Department is signaling that the transfer of strategic weapon systems from extra-hemispheric adversaries like Iran to regimes like Maduro's in Caracas will be met with maximum resistance.
And potentially unilateral enforcement.
That's the implication.
This statement alone likely freezes any potential normalization efforts with the Maduro regime. It makes detente impossible now that Caracas is formally linked to Tehran's proliferation network.
It does. And while we're on the State Department, they're also focused on major structural reform at the United Nations.
This was about the aid pledge.
That's right.
Yeah.
The U.S. announced a pledge of $2 billion for UN humanitarian aid. But the headline number is a little misleading.
How so?
The critical detail is that this figure represents a sharp reduction from previous years. The administration's public demand has been for the UN to adapt, shrink, or die.
So this reduced pledge comes with strings attached, demanding administrative efficiency. What were the specific reform details that Ambassador Jeff Bartos, the Ambassador for Management and Reform, pushed through the Fifth Committee meeting?
Bartos confirmed they achieved quantifiable results immediately. The negotiations in the Fifth Committee resulted in a $570 million saving in the U.S. assessment for the coming year.
Wow.
And on top of that, they secured a reduction of nearly 2,600 posts in the U.N. bureaucracy.
That is a significant shrinking of the workforce. What specific structural goals did they target internally at the U.N.?
They mandated cost containment. They directed the International Civil Service Commission to align the UN compensation margin to the U.S. Civil Service comparator.
So bringing UN pay scales more in line with domestic U.S. standards.
Essentially, yes. They also pushed for pension fund modernization and significantly strengthening the investigative capacity of the Office of Internal Oversight Services, OIOS.
And the goal there?
Particularly regarding cases that could lead to financial recovery from fraud or mismanagement.
So we see the same philosophy applied at the UN that we see domestically with the federal employee pay structure cost containment and shrinking the workforce.
It's the exportation of that structural realignment philosophy, insisting that global bureaucracy adhere to the same efficiency and cost standards being applied at home.
Okay, let's pivot now from foreign pressure to hardening the domestic industrial base and military response capabilities. Let's move into the defense and homeland security realm.
The contract actions over these 48 hours were focused entirely on reinforcing the critical vulnerabilities exposed by great power competition. The most significant action came from the Defense Microelectronics Activity, BMEA, concerning microchip security.
Why is microchip security so urgent for the Department of Defense, for the DoD, right now?
It's a core vulnerability related to system longevity.
Yeah.
I mean, commercial microchip life cycles are constantly shortening, but the DoD relies on decades-old high-performance systems.
Like the F-22, the B-52.
Exactly, or the Aegis radar system.
Yeah.
These systems inevitably face what's called DMS-MS.
Diminishing manufacturing sources and material shortages.
Right. And simply put, the original chip manufacturer might no longer exist, or the components they need are just obsolete.
So if a legacy chip fails in an F-22, the U.S. needs to be able to immediately reverse engineer or fabricate a compatible part domestically, or that plane is grounded.
That's the problem.
What mechanism did the DMEA use to ensure this rapid response capability?
They awarded a massive, multiple award, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract, an IDIQ contract.
Okay.
And this was under the Advanced Technology Support Program V, or ATS-PV. An IDIQ contract basically means it's a pre-vote pool of contractors who can quickly deliver engineering and fabrication services.
Without needing a full, slow bidding process every single time.
Exactly. Every time a legacy chip fails.
That creates a rapid supply chain lifeline. Who are the heavy hitters on that list of contractors?
The list is a clear indicator of the contract's significance. I mean, the 10 key awardees include General Dynamics Mission Systems, Northrop Grumman, Leidos, Raytheon, L3Harris.
All the big names.
The Charles Stark Draper Laboratory, Battelle Memorial Institute, Vertex Aerospace, DRS Network and Imaging Systems, and HII Mission Technologies. This is a comprehensive mobilization of the entire defense industrial base.
And it's all focused on securing the brains of these legacy warfighting systems against obsolescence.
Yes.
Beyond microchips, what logistical bottlenecks is the Air Force trying to accelerate?
They are focused on closing the training gap for the T-7A Red Hawk.
The replacement for the T-38 Talon training aircraft.
Right. Textron Systems was awarded a $41 million purchase order, with options up to $62 million, specifically to support the maintenance training system for the T-7A.
It sounds like they are trying to fix a perennial military problem, having the hardware before you have the people trained to fix it.
That's a classic problem. And in this case, Textron will design and produce the common fuselage structure for the maintenance trainers.
So a high-fidelity replica of the aircraft's structure that never flies.
It never flies. And the immediate impact is acceleration. By ensuring support personnel are trained and ready on realistic, full-scale replicas of the structure before the actual aircraft are delivered, the DoD is eliminating a key logistical bottleneck that could slow the T-7A's deployment.
Now let's look north. Arctic sovereignty, specifically addressing the icebreaker gap relative to Russia and China.
The U.S. Coast Guard announced contracts for the construction of Arctic Security Cutters, or ASCs.
And this is an urgent response.
It's a direct urgent response driven by geopolitical concerns. Mm. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem publicly cited the urgency of reasserting American maritime dominance in the face of two challenges.
Russia's northern sea route.
And China's declaration that it is a near Arctic state.
That geopolitical tension is forcing the U.S. to choose speed over tradition. What's the interesting detail about the contracting partnership here?
It's a joint construction effort. It leverages Bollinger Shipyards in Louisiana and Rauma Marine Constructions in Finland.
Well, Finland, a new NATO ally.
Exactly. And Finland possesses significant specialized expertise in building ice-hardened vessels. Including them prioritizes speed to fleet and external technical knowledge over pure domestic protectionism. It's an acknowledgement that the strategic gap is too urgent to be solved solely through U.S. yards.
Speaking of DHS, 2025 was a year of massive internal workforce fluctuation, and that tells a powerful story about this administration's priorities.
It does. DHS saw a net increase of 6% in its workforce, totaling 271,927 employees listed in its 2025 contingency plan.
But that number masks a profound and deliberate shift in component focus.
A huge shift.
Let's break down the growth components first, which are clearly aligned with enforcement.
Immigration enforcement received the vast majority of resources. The ICE workforce increased by over 500 employees, reportedly meeting its goal of hiring 10,000 new officers.
And that was funded through that massive bill.
The $165 billion One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which provided $8 billion for that purpose. CBP also saw growth of over 1,500 employees, using the $4.1 billion provided in the same legislation for hiring 5,000 customs officers and 3,000 Border Patrol agents.
And the Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard also swelled by nearly 2,000 as part of its Force Design 2028 initiative.
Now, contrast that robust growth with the civilian agencies responsible for cyber and emergency management. Where were the reductions?
The cuts were severe. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, dropped by nearly one-third.
A third.
Shrinking from 3,400 to 2,500 staff as of May 31st, 2025. This was driven by program terminations like ending support for the CISA Multistate Information Sharing and Analysis Center and, voluntary departures due to uncertainty.
And FEMA.
FEMA also saw a noticeable decrease, falling from roughly 25,800 to 23,350 active employees as of June 1st, including 24 senior executives who cited a lack of administrative commitment to the agency's mission.
So the impact is unmistakable. Prioritizing border and immigration enforcement components over civilian cyber defense and emergency management. That's a clear policy choice reflected in the staffing sheets.
Absolutely. And this prioritization extended directly into domestic security operations. Specifically, it manifested in a highly unusual deployment in New Orleans.
Tell us about the National Guard mobilization there for New Year's celebrations.
So 350 National Guard members arrived in New Orleans on Tuesday, December 30th. This deployment, which was authorized by President Trump, is tasked with assisting with security for New Year's celebrations and extending all the way through the upcoming carnival season.
The why behind this deployment is a direct response to a terrorist attack exactly 1 year prior, isn't it?
Precisely. It's a response to the fatal truck attack on Bourbon Street on January 1st, 2025. That attack killed 14 people and exposed profound security vulnerabilities in dense urban areas.
And the attacker
was later identified as Shamsuddin Jabbar, a U.S. citizen and army veteran who supported the Islamic State.
The involvement of a domestic terrorist with military training using a vehicle as a weapon is what dissolved the line between a foreign threat and domestic law enforcement.
It absolutely transformed local security into a federal military mission. These troops are now patrolling the French Quarter alongside state police and Louisiana wildlife and fisheries officers.
And the local response has been temporary.
The city officials' own comments revealed the lack of permanent planning. They noted that the current concrete barricade system is merely a temporary solution to a permanent problem. This deployment is the immediate federal stopgap.
That segment shows us the hard power and immediate security focus. Now let's move into the internal machinery of the government, the administrative state, where we see agencies simultaneously attempting modernization while fighting deconstruction.
We began with the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, and its two competing directives. The first addresses the crippling retirement processing delays caused by the surge from the Deferred Resignation Program, or DRP, earlier in 2025.
OPM Director Scott Kupor sent a letter to Congress on December 30th touting the new online retirement application platform, ORA. Was this a genuine modernization effort or an attempt to deflect blame for staffing reductions?
Well, it was both. Kupor promoted the online retirement application, ORA, platform as the solution, specifically blaming the backlog not on the decrease in HR staff.
Which is about 5%.
Right, about 2,600 employees agency-wide. Instead, he blamed it on inefficient and outdated technology. He's using technology as the scapegoat.
What numbers did he provide to prove the ORA's effectiveness?
He provided a clear comparison point. ORA applications are currently completed in approximately 40 days, compared to the estimated 90 days for the old paper-based applications.
That's a huge difference.
It is. And he also provided a specific anecdote of success, noting that OPM recently fast-tracked 1,500 backlogged ORA applications electronically that had been stuck in various HR departments.
But the challenge of full automation remains, doesn't it? The entire process relies on the payroll providers getting on board.
It does. Kupor noted that the government's major payroll providers, NFC, DFAS, and the IBC, are onboarded. However, he stressed that full, seamless automation is contingent upon their commitment of resources for integration.
So until that final electronic link is fully committed, bottlenecks will remain.
They will. But the 40-day processing time for the applications themselves is a significant improvement.
Now, OPM's second strategy is procedural, focusing on stripping away protections for new federal employees. Tell us about the new proposed regulations for probationary employees.
These new rules were scheduled for Federal Register publication on December 30th, and they constitute a major reduction in workforce due process. They significantly limit the grounds upon which a probationary employee, a new hire typically serving a one-year trial period, can appeal their termination.
What are the only grounds for appeal remaining?
They can only appeal their termination if they allege discrimination based on partisan political reasons or marital status, or if the agency committed a fundamental procedural violation.
Everything else is off the table?
Off the table. And the major structural change here is shifting adjudication authority away from a neutral third party.
From the MSPB?
Correct. It shifts adjudication authority from the Merit Systems Protection Board, MSPB, which functions essentially as an external judge for the federal civil service, to OPM's Internal Merit System Accountability and Compliance, MSAC, office.
What's the practical difference between the MSPB and OPM's internal MSAC for a terminated employee?
The difference is due process friction. The MSPB is slow, it's costly, but it's transparent. It allows for formal hearings and, crucially, the discovery phase, where an employee can gather evidence to challenge the agency's narrative.
And MSAC.
OPM argues MSAC is more efficient because it eliminates those costly MSPB procedures. It eliminates hearings and discovery in most cases, opting instead to make decisions solely based on written record provided by the agency.
Which aligns with that earlier rule.
Perfectly. It aligns with the final rule from June, allowing terminations based on the needs and interests of the agency without the agency having to give a specific reason. The goal is to make firing non-career employees virtually frictionless.
That institutional conflict brings us to the FBI, where security standards are being eroded for political appointees. What did investigative reporting reveal about FBI Director Kash Patel?
It revealed that Director Patel granted unprecedented polygraph waivers to three senior staff.
Who were they?
Deputy Director Dan Bongino, Congressional Liaison Marshall Yates, and Executive Assistant Nicole Rucker.
This is highly unusual.
Very. FBI employees have been required to pass a polygraph since 1994, and experts consulted by reporters called the move unprecedented.
The FBI tried to justify this by claiming they were all Schedule C political appointees who are exempt. Why is that justification suspect?
Well, first, experts point out that Schedule C status does not automatically grant a polygraph exemption in high-security agencies like the FBI.
And second?
Second, only one of the three individuals, Nicole Rucker, is actually listed as a Schedule C political appointee in the Public Plum Book Federal Directory. The designation for the other two is unclear or political, which undermines the Bureau's stated justification.
The deputy director specifically deals with the most sensitive information. What is the security implication of giving that specific role a waiver?
It's a massive security risk. The deputy director routinely receives the president's daily brief, the PDB, and special compartmented information, SCI.
So they need access to SCIFs.
They require unescorted access to secure spaces, or SCIFs, on the seventh floor of FBI headquarters. Waiving this fundamental security safeguard for top political leadership raises immediate, profound questions about vetting integrity and the appearance of a double standard.
It certainly suggests that personal loyalty may be prioritized over established security protocols.
Especially since the reporting highlights that Director Patel has been quite aggressive in using the polygraph requirement on rank-and-file staff to ferret out leaks or negative comments about his own leadership.
The institutional damage here seems significant.
It is a critical tension point between the political leadership and the career security apparatus, and it's currently under active review by congressional oversight committees.
Let's turn briefly to two significant rules published in the Federal Register on December 30th. First, the extension of telemedicine rules.
This was a joint action by the DEA and HHS, publishing the fourth temporary extension rule.
Fourth.
This rule extends the COVID-19 era flexibilities for prescribing controlled substances via telemedicine through December 31st, 2026.
So they are waiving the Ryan Haight Act's requirement for an in-person medical evaluation before prescribing certain medications. Why the extension?
It's a stopgap measure.
Yeah.
It's designed to avoid a catastrophic disruption of care. Millions of Americans rely on remote prescribing for essential services, particularly for mental health and addiction treatment.
So by extending it again, the agencies prevent a massive public health crisis.
We do. However, the fact that this is the fourth temporary extension signals a clear failure to reach a consensus on a permanent regulatory framework.
So they're just kicking the can down the road for another year. The second notable regulatory action involves commercial spaceflight safety.
The U.S. Coast Guard published a proposed rule to establish a permanent safety zone in the Rio Grande River near Boca Chica, Texas. This is directly related to SpaceX.
What's the scope and rationale for that permanent restriction on public access to navigable waters?
The safety zone covers navigable waters within a half-mile radius of the SpaceX Massey's test site. And the Coast Guard's rationale is clearly stated, citing hazards from cryogenics and structural tests of the Starship rocket system.
So the long-term impact is that it formalizes the integration of commercial spaceflight into standard federal safety protocols.
And it does so by permanently ceding public access to a navigable waterway for a private defense and aerospace contractor.
And before we leave the regulatory world, we should quickly note the Federal Reserve and FDIC's technical adjustments regarding the Community Reinvestment Act.
Yes, they announced the 2026 asset thresholds for CRA compliance, which are adjusted annually for inflation.
How much were they raised by?
The thresholds were raised by 2.51% based on the CPIW. The new limits classify a small bank as less than $1.649 billion and an intermediate small bank as between $412 million and $1.649 billion.
And the effect of that?
This technical adjustment reduces the regulatory compliance burden on smaller community banks, which aligns with the administration's overall deregulatory ethos.
That sets the stage for what is arguably the most significant structural shift revealed in this archive, the elevation of the USDA into a full-fledged national security agency.
This is a fundamental change in how the U.S. government views food and land use. Secretary Brick L. Rollins unveiled the National Farm Security Action Plan.
And the premise of this?
It's predicated on the assessment that foreign adversaries, specifically linked to the People's Republic of China, the PRC, are systematically acquiring U.S. agricultural land.
And the threat is bifurcated, correct? It's both economic leverage and intelligence gathering.
Exactly. The stated threats are gaining leverage over the U.S. food supply and, crucially, conducting surveillance near adjacent critical military installations like missile silos and Air Force bases.
They're treating fertile ground as potential foreign territory for intelligence collection.
That's the framing.
What is the cornerstone action they are taking to address this through regulatory reform?
They are radically overhauling the Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act of 1978, AFIDA.
Right. And historically, that system was leaky.
Very. It relied on paper-based self-reporting by foreign buyers, a system that was cumbersome and easily circumvented using layers of shell companies and corporate anonymity.
And the action taken on December 30th.
USDA opened an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, an ANPRM. And the two key changes are digitizing the reporting process and fundamentally mandating the disclosure of ultimate beneficial ownership.
That is the game changer. Mandating ultimate beneficial ownership means forcing foreign companies to name the individual or corporation at the very top of the ownership structure. How does that change the USDA's function?
It converts the USDA from a passive data gathering organization into an active domestic intelligence collector.
Wow.
The strategic intent is to create a granular, verified map of foreign land ownership, enabling the government to identify ownership clusters near critical infrastructure. It's integrating agricultural data into the broader national intelligence picture for the first time.
That sounds like an entirely new mission profile for that department. What is Action 2, the program exclusion? It looks designed to weaponize federal procurement power.
That's the immediate update to the BioPreferred program and USDA-guaranteed lending programs. The rule categorically declares that entities domiciled in or controlled by foreign adversary countries are ineligible for these federal benefits.
What is the economic impact of that immediate exclusion?
It is significant economic pressure. The BioPreferred program mandates that federal agencies prioritize bio-based products and procurement. By excluding adversarial entities, the USDA is forcing Chinese or Russian-owned agricultural subsidiaries operating in the U.S. to choose.
Divest their ownership or lose access to lucrative government contracts and subsidized federal capital.
Exactly. It is a powerful incentive to achieve the goal of reshoring the agricultural supply chain.
And finally, they addressed intellectual property theft in this sector.
Action 3 involves new protocols to safeguard intellectual property. We're talking about genomic data and advanced ag tech like precision farming algorithms. These protocols explicitly restrict the transfer of USDA-funded research to entities linked to hostile nations.
So it mirrors restrictions we already see in defense.
It mirrors the restrictions already in place for defense contractors and semiconductor manufacturing. This plan demonstrates a comprehensive view of farming and food production as strategic military and economic assets.
Now let's shift gears again and look at the judiciary. The one branch designed to check executive power to see how they reacted to this flurry of activity.
This is perhaps the most significant immediate check on the executive branch during this 48-hour window. The case is National Treasury Employees Union v. Vought.
Centering on the administration's aggressive attempt to defund the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB.
Yes.
The CFPB is unique because it's funded by transfers from the Federal Reserve, not the annual congressional appropriations process. What was the administration's creative legal pretext for shutting off the money?
The strategy was brilliant in its legal gymnastics. Acting CFPB Director Russell Vought, supported by the DOJ Office of Legal Counsel, argued that because the Federal Reserve was running a loss...
Due to high interest rates.
Right, due to paying high interest on reserve balances to manage inflation, it had zero combined earnings.
And since the CFPB's funding is tied to those earnings...
Statutorily capped by the Fed's earnings under the Dodd-Frank Act, Vought argued he was legally barred from submitting a funding request.
That would have been a pocket veto, an administrative shutdown leading to mass furloughs without requiring Congress to act. How did U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson respond on December 30th?
She rejected the argument decisively. She granted the NTU's motion to clarify an existing preliminary injunction compelling Vought to submit the funding request to the Federal Reserve immediately.
And her holding was strongly worded.
It was. She described the OLC's interpretation as unsupported and, critically, a transparent attempt to bypass the statutory insulation Dodd-Frank was specifically designed to create.
That language, transparent attempt, shows the court recognized the political maneuver for what it was. What's the immediate practical impact of her ruling?
It ensures the CFPB remains solvent through the first quarter of 2026, preventing the immediate shutdown and mass layoffs Vought had planned. This is a powerful institutional victory for the administrative state.
And a significant check on the executive strategy of deconstructing independent agencies through novel interpretations of funding formulas.
It is.
Let's move to the D.C. Circuit, the court that constantly reviews regulatory bodies, specifically the energy sector case, independent market monitor for PJMB FERC. What was the core dispute involving the grid operator?
So PJM Interconnection manages the power grid for 13 states and D.C. The independent market monitor, the IMM, is essentially the watchdog.
Okay.
The IMM argued that PJM improperly excluded it from liaison committee governance meetings, claiming that without attending those high-level discussions, its ability to detect market manipulation was hindered.
And the court, denying the monitor's petition, sided with the grid operator. What was Judge Henderson's core reasoning?
She held that the IMM failed to demonstrate a legally cognizable interest in attending internal governance meetings. The court ruled that access to the data required for monitoring prices and capacity was sufficient under the Federal Power Act.
So the monitor's job is to review the numbers, not necessarily participate in the organizational deliberation?
Precisely. This protects the autonomy of the regional transmission organizations, RTOs like PJM, allowing them to manage their internal deliberations without the constant intrusive presence of the watchdog.
A victory for grid operators focused on efficiency. Finally, we turn to the Fifth Circuit, known for its strict procedural enforcement, which issued a series of defining rulings on December 30th, starting with the high-stakes death penalty case, Juan Carlos Alvarez v. Bobby Lumpkin.
The court affirmed the denial of federal habeas relief for Alvarez, a Texas death row inmate convicted of the 1998 murders of Michael Aguirre and Jose Varela.
And Alvarez raised serious claims.
He did. Ineffective counsel alleging his attorney slept during the trial and unreliable DNA evidence.
How did the Fifth Circuit navigate those claims?
They applied the highly deferential standard of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, or AEDPA. The court found that even if the alleged errors occurred, the overwhelming evidence of guilt.
Eyewitness testimony, admissions.
Right. It rendered any potential error harmless. And the impact is significant. This exhausts Alvarez's primary federal appeals, moving him one step closer to execution.
Next, the court weighed in on qualified immunity in a lethal force case, Ramirez v. Granado. The Fifth Circuit is notoriously protective of police immunity, but there was a significant nuance here.
This was a per curiam opinion, but Judge James L. Dennis's concurrence provided the necessary check. While the circuit maintains strong protection for police, Judge Dennis emphasized that genuine disputes of material fact.
For instance, whether the suspect actually posed an immediate threat.
Exactly. Those must be resolved by a jury, not by judges at the summary judgment stage.
That is a small but important reaffirmation of the jury's role in contested excessive force claims. It maintains a necessary check.
It preserves that adversarial process. And finally, the court issued a classic ruling on procedural default in Moore v. Itawamba County.
What was the specific procedural trap that ended that pro-se civil rights lawsuit?
The court affirmed the dismissal of the Section 1983 civil rights lawsuit based purely on procedural default. The plaintiff, Richard Matthew Moore, failed to brief or challenge the district court's specific reason for dismissal, which was lack of subject matter jurisdiction, in his appeal filing.
So, by failing to address that jurisdictional threshold,
the court ruled he waived his right to appellate review on the merits of his case. It just illustrates how often technical rules end civil rights litigation prematurely.
We've covered the executive, the administrative state, and the judiciary. Let's move to the legislative branch, even while technically in recess.
Even during the holidays, Congress engaged in specific procedural maneuvers to maintain its institutional power against the executive.
Tell us about the pro forma sessions on December 30th.
The House met at 1 p.m., the Senate at 1:30 p.m.
Yeah.
These are non-legislative sessions, no business is conducted. Their sole purpose is to prevent the Senate from going into recess for more than 3 days.
Which is a critical constitutional defense mechanism.
It is.
That blocks the president's ability to make recess appointments under Article 2, Section 2.
Precisely. It ensures that even during a period of recess, the executive branch must submit all nominations for confirmation, preserving institutional checks and balances.
While they met, they also set the table for the January agenda by formally introducing measures. What legislative priorities stood out?
Senator Britt, a Republican from Alabama, introduced S-3416, a bill to prohibit public comments from governments and individuals designated as foreign adversaries.
That's significant. It directly seeks to codify the executive branch's expansive anti-foreign adversary policy push that we just saw with the USDA's new rules.
A clear sign that the Senate intends to provide legislative backing for the executive's national security policies.
What else was introduced?
Senator Welch, a Democrat from Vermont, introduced S-3411, which aims to amend the Securities Exchange Act regarding the Advocate for Small Business Capital Formation. And Senator Husted, a Republican from Ohio, introduced S-3286, focusing on reforming the VA appeals process.
We also saw new developments in the high-profile legal troubles of Congresswoman Sheila Cherfulis McCormick.
The Florida Democrat appeared outside a Miami federal courthouse on December 30th, reiterating her innocence. Her arraignment was rescheduled to January 20th.
And the bond details.
She was freed on a $60,000 bond and was required to surrender her personal passport, though she does retain her congressional passport, to continue performing her duties.
What are the specific and serious federal charges she faces?
She faces 15 federal counts. They're extensive. The core allegation involved conspiring to steal $5 million in federal COVID-19 disaster funds that were mistakenly overpaid to her family's company, Trinity Healthcare Services, in 2021.
And the charges go beyond theft.
They do. They include theft of government funds, straw donor contributions alleging she routed funds to her campaign money laundering, and false tax statements.
And the detail that brings this fraud down to a very human, almost unbelievable level.
The federal indictment alleges that within 2 months of receiving the mistakenly overpaid funds in 2021, over $100,000 was spent on a 3-carat yellow diamond ring for the Congresswoman.
Wow.
The contrast between emergency COVID disaster funds and that specific lavish personal purchase really underscores the gravity of the alleged fraud.
That level of fraud brings us directly to the explosive crackdown announced in Minnesota regarding state services.
Federal authorities made two coordinated announcements. First, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, announced it is freezing child care payments to Minnesota.
And at the same time.
Simultaneously. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, announced a massive operation specifically designed to identify, arrest, and remove criminals who are defrauding the American people.
The scale of the alleged fraud Republicans are citing is truly staggering, up to $9 billion.
It is. Republicans citing state audits allege up to $9 billion in suspected or proven fraud since 2019 in state programs, including child care and assisted living.
And they cited specific examples.
They did. The DHS operation, announced through their social media, targets these state service programs. They cited the example of Ghandi Mohammed, a defendant already indicted in the Feeding Our Future scandal, who owns assisted living facilities that brought in $2.3 million from the state last year alone.
And this federal enforcement effort has clear immigration policy overtones.
It does. The allegations of fraud have been consistently tied to the large Somali community in Minnesota, which has become a focal point for the administration's broader immigration enforcement campaign.
This follows other actions.
It follows the ending of legal protections for Somalis in November and DHS specifically targeting visa fraud in the region in December. The message is clear. The administration is linking domestic fraud enforcement directly to immigration status enforcement.
And speaking of immigration enforcement, a U.S. district judge ruled on HHS sharing Medicaid data with ICE.
That's right. The judge ruled against a lawsuit brought by over 20 Democratic states allowing HHS to share Medicaid data with ICE.
What was the judge's reasoning?
The judge ruled that it is within ICE's power to acquire the location data from HHS, provided the data only involves undocumented immigrants for use in deportation cases.
And that's starting soon.
This authorization for data sharing is scheduled to begin on January 6th. This is a major win for immigration enforcement efforts seeking to leverage federal data sets for operational purposes.
We have completed the unabridged operational archive of December 30th and 31st, 2025. What emerges is a picture of profound structural change across the government.
The overarching theme is the total dissolution of traditional policy barriers. We saw domestic concerns like agricultural land ownership, and state welfare fraud explicitly redefined and treated as Tier 1 national security threats.
With departments like USDA and DHS using national security justifications for unprecedented intervention.
Right, and institutionally, the data reveals a fascinating aggressive tension. On one side, the administration is radically expanding executive power, unilateral financial sanctions, the Farm Security Plan, eroding internal security protocols like the FBI polygraph waivers for loyalists.
But simultaneously, the executive branch faced immediate and significant judicial checks.
Immediate checks. Judge Amy Berman Jackson stopped the administration's pocket veto strategy against the CFPB, and the Fifth Circuit, despite its conservative leanings, reinforced the jury's essential role in reviewing contested qualified immunity cases.
The courts are actively reining in the executive's reach.
They are.
This tension, this aggressive push for maximum agility and minimal bureaucratic friction like OPM, replacing the external MSPB with the internal MSAC for employee appeals and allowing immediate firings of probationers, it's happening at the same moment the administrative state is preparing for the next major technology leap.
That leap is the transition to agentic experience, or AX. This is where intelligent agents act as collaborators, streamlining complex multi-system workflows.
And the promise of AX is built on certain principles.
It is. It's built on principles like transparency, control, reliability, and ethics. The human user has to be able to understand the agent's reasoning, intervene if necessary, and trust its operation.
And here's the core contradiction revealed by these 48 hours. The federal workforce, which is the necessary human layer of oversight required to guarantee these AI systems act ethically and transparently, mm-hmm. is simultaneously being streamlined, reduced in key civilian agencies like CISA and FEMA, and subjected to immediate, non-transparent procedural upheaval like OPM's MSSC replacing the MSPB.
And that leads to the fundamental, provocative question for you, the listener. As the government aggressively moves toward powerful, autonomous AI collaborators and agentic systems, how will the remaining, streamlined human workforce, a workforce actively dealing with staff cuts and fractured human systems, maintain the institutional stability and ethical oversight required to ensure these new, powerful AI agents act ethically and transparently?
Especially when the human systems they are meant to augment are themselves being dismantled.
That's the question.
The human systems are being fractured just as the artificial intelligence is being granted unprecedented authority. That is the fundamental challenge for the administrative state moving into 2026. A truly exhaustive look at a critical 48 hours of federal operations. Thank you for guiding us through this deep dive.
My pleasure. Thank you for making sure we captured every granular detail.
And thank you for joining us. We invite you to continue exploring these topics, the complex interplay between policy, power, and procedure as the government barrels toward 2026. We'll talk to you next time on the Deep Dive.